Voting begins in Russia in an election all but certain to tighten President Vladimir Putin's grip on power.
He certainly will add this to the reasons he feels emboldened and more confident in what he's doing and how he's doing it.
And Israel rejects Hamas' proposed hostage release truce deal amid growing U.S. pressure on Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's government to change course.
Israel cannot survive if it becomes a pariah.
Plus, cybersecurity experts are sounding alarm as artificial intelligence gets smarter and more capable of creating disinformation that could sway elections worldwide and ahead of the upcoming U.S. presidential election in November. Today is Saturday, March 16th. Join us as we explore the issues in the news. Hello, I'm Lori London in Washington. Voting is now underway at polling stations across Russia and in illegally annexed regions of Ukraine. With his outspoken critics jailed, dead, or in exile, victory is all but certain for President Vladimir Putin. Associated Press correspondent Charles de Ledesma begins our coverage.
The election takes place against the backdrop of a ruthless crackdown that's crippled independent media and prominent rights groups and given Putin full control of the political system. Russia's scattered opposition has urged those unhappy with President Vladimir Putin all the war to show up at the polls at noon on Sunday, the final day of voting, in protest. The strategy was endorsed by the late opposition leader Alexei Navalny not long before his death. His widow, Yulia Navalnaya, says, "We need to use election day to show that we exist, and there are many of us. We are actual, living, real people, and we are against Putin. What to do next is up to you." I'm Charles de Ledesma.
And joining us now for a deeper look at the Russian election's implications is James Townsend, senior fellow with the Center for a New American Security, who previously served as Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for European and NATO policy.
What impact would you say the crackdown has been having or is having?
Well, a couple things. One is the crackdown started years ago. Putin began to shape his civil society, and including the media and think tanks and this type of thing, years ago to make sure that they either supported his views and making sure particularly that they weren't going to be undercutting him one way or another. And so he's been at it for a while. When the election happened, of course, you could see how he controlled that from Navalny until any other potential candidate might have, you know, raised their head over the parapet. He made sure that they were not going to be part of the scene. And civil society, of course, is now suppressed, and the media really touts his line. So you have, on the one hand, just total absence of anyone that will oppose him or will speak badly about him or undercut him. And so that's what a totalitarian dictator does, and that's what he's got going. And so this election is a bit of a kabuki dance. I'm sure Adolf Hitler went through elections as well. We know he did at the very beginning of his time there in Berlin. But this is just something that is a bit of a joke. But on the flip side, I will say that you saw the outpouring of emotion and very brave efforts made by Russians to go lay flowers at, you know, at the funeral and at the memorials for Navalny. So there is an opposition there. There is a feeling of not being happy with the state of affairs in Russia. But people are very reluctant to express it because they're under that total control. But I think certainly what we saw with Navalny's funeral reassured a lot of us that there was still a beating heart in an opposition, but it's way underground, and it's certainly not having much of an effect in Russia.
Right. And with Putin tightening his grip on power and, as you said, controlling the domestic media narrative, imposing its citizenship on Ukrainian occupied territories, will a Putin election victory likely lead to him using this as proof of overwhelming public support for the war in Ukraine? And how will it impact Ukraine?
Well, I think for sure he will use this both internal to Russia, but also externally in Europe and others who might wave their finger at what he's doing. He might say, well, I was just reelected by a huge amount, so obviously the Russian people back me. He'll certainly have that as a narrative going out. And it might even have an impact in Russia, too. Although I think most Russians know this is a kabuki dance, if you will. In Ukraine, I'm not sure we'll see an impact in terms of what's happening on the battlefield or anything else. I think with the election behind him and able to use the propaganda, he certainly will add this to the reasons he feels emboldened and more confident in what he's doing and how he's doing it. And so it will have an impact attack mainly, I think, with trying to put aside any problems domestically that might try to derail what he's doing, what Putin is doing. I think, if anything, that will impact how Putin approaches issues like Ukraine or anything else. I think he's going to feel more confident, and he doesn't have a little worry in the back of his mind that people might take to the streets. Just to make the point, he was very concerned about having the kinds of trouble that came to Moscow during Afghanistan and during the Grozny Chechnya fighting a number of years ago, where the mothers of those people, of those soldiers who had died, protested. And that became quite a domestic pressure. And Putin was around the government during those days. And he saw that, he felt that, and he's been trying to avoid that kind of thing. And certainly this election will give him some confidence that maybe he's escaped that kind of protest.
Do you think he'll toughen his course to escalate the war?
I think he will do that one way or another. I don't think the election would have been an obstacle towards him doing something like that. You know, fearful for the reaction among the electorate if he had done an escalation. I don't think that ever bothered him. But I think your point's well taken, in the sense that even if that was a little bit of a concern in the back of his mind, that certainly is gone now. And he certainly would feel free to escalate or do anything else he wants to do, because he won't have people marching in the street the way he was worried about a year or two ago. I think, if anything, he's going to press full steam ahead with doing whatever he feels he needs to do in Ukraine.
Wouldn't emboldened Putin also likely become even more aggressive with efforts to deepen divides in the West?
You're absolutely right. I think this emboldens him to not only be more aggressive rhetorically towards the West. We've heard him talking very specifically now about the nuclear specter, that if the West put troops into Ukraine or did something else that made Putin feel threatened, that he would play a nuclear card. He's been very explicit about that now. And I think certainly that shows us an emboldened Putin that probably feels that way because, you know, the elections are behind him and that kind of thing. But also, we're going to see an emboldened Putin should the Ukraine fighting resolve itself in the coming years, beginning to work out of the fighting. I think we'll see an emboldened Putin who might be looking elsewhere for other targets. You know, a number of the European ministers of defense have been warning about that if you have an emboldened Putin who has a military that's now been recapitalized and strengthened because the fighting has now stopped in Ukraine and a lot of the efforts to rebuild the Russian military are beginning to take hold, you'll have an emboldened and more aggressive Putin to deal with in the future as well. So, bottom line is, this election can obviously help him feel more confident, and a more confident Putin is something that we will likely see in a couple of years if he finds himself victorious in dealing with Ukraine.
He has, as you mentioned, continued his threats to use nuclear weapons just a couple of days ago. Is this just saber rattling, or is it something that is more concerning and really needs to be taken seriously?
Well, I think it always needs to be taken seriously. And we do. I think the U.S. government certainly does, as do the allies, watching very carefully for signs that he's beginning to move warheads around or beginning to do something that he should not be thinking of doing. So we're all taking it seriously. We're all watching it. But there is certainly the reason he is even talking about it in the first instance is because it is saber rattling. And that does have an impact in Europe. You see leadership in European capitals react to that by saying, no, we're not going to put troops in Ukraine. No, we don't want escalation, etc. So he knows he can get a reaction out of European leadership. He will play with the European sensibilities every now and then by rattling that nuclear saber just to see the recoil.
Should the West categorically refuse to recognize and condemn the voting in these presidential elections, including on the occupied territories in Ukraine?
That's such a joke, isn't it? That they're voting with a gun to their head and they're watching very carefully what those votes are and who's voting the other way. So they're, like I said, this is just, they're going through the motions. This is a kabuki dance. And I think we could certainly condemn it and say this is not the signs of a healthy functioning democracy and, you know, a fair election and all of that. I think that's certainly not open to another interpretation. But in terms of recognizing it, I think we're recognizing a reality that is Russia now, and we're going to have to deal with Putin no matter if his election was free and fair or not. And so there we are. We're just going to have to hold our nose and make sure everyone knows that what's taking place in Russia in terms of elections is not the way democracies work. But we'll have to deal with Putin for years to come, and that's just going to be a reality for us.
James Townsend, Senior Fellow with the Center for a New American Security. Thank you so much. Turning now to the crisis in the Middle East. Relatives of hostages still being held in Gaza protested outside a meeting of Israel's war cabinet Friday. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's office said a new Hamas proposal for a ceasefire was based on unrealistic demands, but it said it will be discussed.
We know that there's a deal on the table. We know that this might be the last chance to bring back more than 70 hostages alive and to bring all the hostages that are already dead and bring them to bury them here in Israel. We know that there's a deal on the table, that Hamas gave an answer. We expect the Israeli government to do what it needs to do and close this deal and bring all the hostages back. That's money time.
According to the Hamas proposal seen by Reuters, the initial stage of the deal will include the release of women, children, elderly, and ill hostages in return for the release of 700 to 1,000 Palestinians held in Israeli prisons. Palestinians held the first Ramadan Friday prayers amid the rubble of a destroyed mosque. With the deepening humanitarian catastrophe, where the United Nations says a quarter of Gaza's population is starving, Israel's government faces increasing pressure from the U.S. President Joe Biden Friday expressed support for Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, who the day before called for new elections in Israel and said Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is a key obstacle to Middle East peace.
The Netanyahu coalition no longer fits the needs of Israel after October 7th. The world has changed radically since then, and the Israeli people are being stifled right now by a governing vision that is stuck in the past.
His counterpart, Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, blasted Schumer for making the comments.
It is grotesque and hypocritical for Americans who hyperventilate about foreign interference in our own democracy to call for the removal of a democratically elected leader of Israel.
I spoke with John Linden, executive director of the Alliance for Middle East Peace, who was in Washington last week, who talked about the need for Israelis and Palestinians to see each other's pain and insecurity.
We had Israelis and Palestinians together who've just paid the ultimate price in this war, sitting in congressional offices, explaining to members of Congress, who themselves are sometimes partisan on this issue, how unhelpful that is for them. Right, and saying that we are able to see and empathize and understand the trauma that the other has gone through. And I mean, empathize isn't even a strong enough word. It was very powerful. We had Tamal and Yonatan saying, like, I have gone through something so similar. There's a sense of partnership and solidarity and recognition, right, in the trauma and the loss that each has had. And I think we, who have been so lucky not to have suffered that, need to really recognize that if those that have paid this ultimate price are able to be strong enough and far-sighted enough to dedicate themselves to partnership towards this goal of Israeli peace and equality, who are we not to get behind them? I think that obviously has a political dimension for what we need to see is policymakers embrace internationally. But there's also a role for the rest of us who aren't policymakers. Like, what sort of information are we sharing? What sort of rhetoric are we participating in? Are we escalating tensions between both parties? And if we are, how is that helping? Rather than trying to focus people's minds on resolution of the conflict and building that sense of solidarity amongst us as well. Because we know here in Washington that as soon as something becomes incredibly partisan and divided, there's political utility in sustaining that. Whereas if we can demonstrate that there's, you know, consensus, that people coming from different perspectives can agree on this end goal of wanting to end this conflict and work diplomatically, then that consensus is very powerful in our partisan moment.
And what are your hopes for the future? Do you see, I mean, this is a decades-long complex situation. President Biden, as you know, in his State of the Union, reiterated that the only real hope for peace is two-state solution where Palestinians live in safety and have their own identity and and Israel as well. Israel has approved plans for 3,400 new homes in the West Bank settlements. So if that's really the solution to peace, how do we get there?
So, I mean, for the Biden administration, I mean, I watched the State of the Union as well. I mean, we need to make sure that rhetoric is followed through upon, not just by the United States, but by all international actors, right? The level of attention that is paid when violence reaches this devastating clip, right? That needs to be sustained when the guns fall silent as well. And this is something that we need to be very sharp-eyed about. Too often, once the violence ends or subsides or drops in intensity, the world moves on. The media, policymakers, everybody else, and then damning us to repetition of this cycle again in future. We need to almost capture the level of attention and political centrality at its apex when a ceasefire is included and sustain that, right? Kind of like freeze it and keep it at that level for the duration of a diplomatic process that's focused very clearly on ending the conflict. And too often, international leaders have failed to do that. And it's very important as well for Palestinians, and we were having this conversation yesterday. They have seen terrible violence used on October 7th result in that political centrality internationally. And for a young Palestinian frustrated with their lives, that's a terrible incentive to set down. You want to demonstrate that diplomacy, nonviolence, engagement, partnership with counterparts in Israel can produce an outcome that can give them freedom and independence, right? That there's a path they can see that is real and stacks up and they can put their faith into. And I think there's an obligation now for the Biden administration and the international community to sketch that path out on the other side of the war. And I think also you mentioned about settlement construction and, you know, various unhelpful and beyond unhelpful, devastating actions being taken that push peace further away. These need to be dealt with much more substantively than we've seen in the past. If we're serious about a credible resolution to the conflict, we have to then take the steps necessary to make that realistic and to make the parties on the ground understand that the international community is serious about it. And also, maybe the most important part for me, to give ordinary Israelis and Palestinians a role in this so that it's not a conversation taking place in the White House or in, you know, fancy conference centers around the world. It's something on the streets in Israel, Palestine, that ordinary citizens have a stake in, a responsibility and a role in, and shaping and building the deep, deep roots that conflict resolution requires. That's never been done in Israel-Palestine. We have diplomacy that starts every few years for a few months, only at the elite level that citizens read about in newspapers, but do not see a connection with their own lives. And we need to see civil society groups invested in and scaled so that they can really take that process to the streets, to the families and communities in both societies, and actually begin the process of conflict resolution from the bottom up in tandem with the diplomatic process from the top down.
John Linden, Executive Director of the Alliance for Middle East Peace. You're listening to Issues in the News. I'm Lori London. The U.S. ambassador to the United Nations and 40 of her colleagues from other countries put forward a resolution this week that calls on member states to promote safe, secure, and trustworthy artificial intelligence systems. Morocco's U.N. ambassador Omar Halale stressed both the positive and potentially destructive aspects of AI.
The potential of artificial intelligence to accelerate human development is huge. At the same time, it is important to be aware of the malicious use of this technology, which can have very serious consequences for global peace and security and development.
Artificial intelligence is supercharging the threat of election disinformation worldwide, making it easy to create fake but convincing content aimed at fooling voters. As the U.S. presidential race heats up, FBI Director Christopher Wray recently warned about the growing threat, given how easy AI is for foreign adversaries to engage in malign influence. Joining us now is Chris Bronk, Associate Professor of Information Science and Technology at the University of Houston. Why is this raising alarm ahead of the election?
Well, I think that 2016 gave us a pretty good idea of how social media could be used to push out messages that weren't exactly straightforward. And even with Facebook, so if you make an election television commercial or a radio ad even, that advertisement has to be labeled and say, this was created by this campaign. Social media has basically broken that rule. You know, I wrote after the 2016 election, many others did, and said, Facebook really should put something on political content that says who paid for it so we can follow the money and determine where it's coming from. Because we had Facebook being used by foreign powers in 2016 to put messages to audiences that were designed to sway voter opinion. Now, swaying voter opinion doesn't always add up to concrete changes in votes. But it's a form of propaganda engaged in by foreign powers, especially, that we're concerned about. And so what we're really thinking about here is, writ large, how do you either convince people not to vote, which definitely happened with Facebook in 2016, where Black voters were told, you don't want to vote for Hillary Clinton, stay home. And we have now many new things that AI is doing. So, you know, the big concern I think people latch onto are these deepfakes where, you know, it sounds like, you know, Barack Obama or Joe Biden or Donald Trump, it must be them, it must be real. And it's not, it's manufactured by computer. And it's, those technologies are getting better and better. I mean, a good way to look at it is, it's been 8 years since 2016, right? And computing power doubles roughly every 2 to 3 years, but we'll just say two. So that means that computing has quadrupled its power in the last 8 years. So that means all these things that were primitive in that election cycle are now more mature. And so the problem is, you know, once an idea gets out there, making it go away is impossible. We don't have a simple answer for technologically saying this is false. And the companies, the platforms that serve up this information, you know, you look at Twitter, now X, I mean, they just don't do it anymore. And they say, whatever we put on this platform is what we put on the platform. It's a reflection of you guys, and we're not going to moderate it. Sorry. Facebook's maybe a little bit better at it, but it's expensive to do and they don't want to do it. So it's a combination of things. It's the technology, it's understanding the human condition, and then it's understanding the profit motive of companies that want to put, you know, resources into what makes them money, not what costs them money. And this is all just, it becomes a massive tidal wave of concern for us on our ideas that are incorrect, inaccurate, wrong, outright lies, you know, propagating across the internet and convincing people of things that are grossly untrue.
If it's blurring reality, could it be a real threat to democracy where it's just eroding the public's trust in what they see and what they hear?
Yeah, I think that blurring of reality is an excellent point, because when you can start manufacturing speech that didn't happen or propagating ideas that maybe are residing on the flimsiest of proof, you suddenly have this issue where democracy isn't designed to be fast. And we know that. The founders had a pretty good idea that making big changes was something that was supposed to be pretty hard. And that makes sense. And then we live in this digital world where things happen very quickly. Ideas can propagate extremely rapidly. And the political system in a democracy where we reside doesn't necessarily react to those ideas very quickly at all. There was a study done at MIT years ago where they looked at untruth propagating across Twitter. And outlandish and untruthful stories spread across Twitter much more rapidly than true stuff. Why? Because as part of the human condition, it sounds like we're more interested in the outlandish and the unbelievable than the regular information we're used to consuming. So I think that that's part of the problem, that people latch on to things that are maybe not to be expected or outside of the norm more easily. But then when you supercharge this with artificial intelligence, it can massively create content used to build all sorts of images, can create, you know, pictures that aren't real but can be inflammatory. When you start having the outlandish outweigh the actual, that's a very concerning place for a democracy.
These deepfakes in particular are especially hard to verify. And it's understandable that voters, if we're talking about our elections, might fall for the deception. Has this technology already been unleashed in something that can't be really tamed down?
I think that the technology is going to keep marching forward. And really, it comes down to the civic capacity of society. I spent a week in Finland last fall with a NATO EU center that does hybrid warfare. And hybrid warfare is everything from propaganda to terrorism to you name it, unconventional conflict. And one of the things that came from my visit was talking to the Finns about how they do civics. And they teach civics and information civics to their population starting at an early age. And it's embedded throughout curriculum so people can make better decisions about what they read and see. So there's a health civics, which basically says, you know, if you eat these berries, you're going to lose weight. And people say, well, that seems kind of specious. Or political civics, that this candidate believes this. And it's like, well, I've never seen that anywhere else. Why would this be real? So it's basically teaching the critical thinking of understanding information from the internet that is a fundamental skill that needs to grow in democracies for democracies to work, for people to make good decisions. And unfortunately, in the United States, we're not seeing that debate. We're seeing a debate where political actors are saying, we need to ban this book, or we need to make this idea go away because we don't like it. And what you really want to do is train a population to look at all the information and say, you know what, this makes sense to me, and this doesn't, and these are the reasons why. And there's a whole curriculum on good reasoning, on information based on being a skeptic, essentially. This is something that's happening in a few democracies around the world, but it's not happening in the United States.
Chris Bronk, we appreciate your taking the time to speak with us. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week. On behalf of all of us here at VOA, thank you for listening. Join us next week for more Issues in the News. Until then, I'm Lori London.